The title of Brother Mac's exhortation today is The Signs of the Times, a Prophetic Review. And he's asked us to read a couple of verses, first from Daniel and then from Revelation. Daniel 12, verse 1, reads as follows. And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. And Revelation chapter 16, verses 15 and 16. Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. And he gathered them together into a place called, in the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon. Once again, the title today is The Signs of the Times, a Prophetic Review.
My dear brothers and sisters in Christ Jesus our Lord, you may have been expecting Hebrews chapter 6 this morning, and I decided to take a small break from Hebrews this morning, only because this time every year, you know, I tend to become very reflective on current events and what's happening. You know, one of the things that I've tried not to do for a great many years in my life is be very, well, I never was very dogmatic about certain prophetic things as far as, you know, when's the Lord going to return, but I realized that when I was younger, I probably sounded very dogmatic. So while I, you know, certainly don't want to sound definitive, I've always thought and been somewhat firmly convinced, maybe firmly convinced is the right word, you know, I don't know, that, you know, the spring will see the return of our Lord. You know, during our gathering, I was struck by Brother Paul Horton's comments by the fact that Daniel saw his vision of the man of the one on the 21st day of the first month of the Hebrew year. Well, that whole depiction is the depiction of resurrection, isn't it? In the multitudinous Christ. So, is there any reason why he saw that on the 21st day? Well, who knows? Maybe. So, I thought this morning we would take just a few moments and talk about some things that are happening in the world, and we'll pick back up with our regular study on Hebrews as we go forward in future exhortations. You know, as we observe the world events around us, I think it's very important that we are aware what these events may be leading. Well, we know what they're leading to. Let me rephrase that. We know it's important that we understand what all events are leading to. Sometimes we don't always necessarily understand what the particular current happening, how it's going to affect where we know things are going. And sometimes that becomes a little bit troublesome. A little bit difficult to see. But I think there's a lot of things going on that bears our attention. Okay, we're going to try to present a small review of something that would normally take 6 hours. Okay, and that doesn't mean that we're going to, so don't panic. But let's talk about a few things here. Let's talk about, in just a way of review, Nebuchadnezzar's image. All right? And I know that a lot of the things that I'll say here, y'all have heard me say before, but maybe some of you younger Bible students might, maybe some of it will click just for the first time. Well, in Daniel chapter 2, we have what I strongly suggest to you is the blueprint of prophecy. All right? If your belief about what you think is going to happen in prophecy doesn't fit in Daniel 2, then that should tell you something. It is a blueprint for prophecy. Daniel saw an image which, Nebuchadnezzar saw, Daniel interpreted, an image of which Daniel says very clearly in the 28th verse of Daniel chapter 2, relates to the latter days. Now, very often, I think the first thing that we learned is when we're young in the truth, when we're in Sunday school classes, is we learn the historical progression of the image. But that's not what Daniel saw. Okay? Daniel did not see a head of gold that existed by itself. You know, just a head floating in the air. He didn't see breast and arms by themselves. He saw a whole image head to toe. And so it's important for us to pay attention to that. Well, we know that in the image, the first empire represented is the Babylonian Empire, right? So Nebuchadnezzar was told he was the head of gold. So we start with that as our first of the world dominions, which makes up this one great dominion in the end. I want you to pay attention to the fact that in this Arabian Peninsula right here, because we're going to see that on these slides, that it was not part of the head of gold's territory. All right? Pay attention to that fact. We know that the next empire represented was Medo-Persia. And once again, you'll see that this Saudi Arabian Peninsula was not part of that empire. Babylon was a part of it, which is significant and important. But Saudi Arabia was not. And the dates on this slide are guidelines. You know, we know that everybody has a little bit differencing on datings. If I had made this slide myself, I probably would have chosen 542 as a start date. But that's not that important. We know that the next world empire to come along was the Greek Empire. And once again, notice the Saudi Arabian Peninsula not a part of it. But you will note that Babylon was. And then the fourth world empire. And this is very, very critical, because when Daniel goes through the dream, young and old, pay attention to the fact that he only talks about four world empires. He never talks about a fifth. He specifically mentions four. So we can't add a fifth into this. You know, that's always very important. So we go on and we find the Roman Empire was the fourth world empire that came along, represented by the iron in the legs and also in the feet, because the iron's in the feet as well. The feet are not a new kingdom. Note that once again, my pointer all of a sudden doesn't want to work. Well, there we go. I knew that was going to happen to me. Let's go back one. Technology is great till it doesn't work. Note that Saudi Arabia was not in the Roman Empire. Okay? But I want you to note also that all of the kingdom of Babylon wasn't either, which is a really important point. You know, different maps show different extents, but as far as Babylon proper and Assyria proper, you know, Rome never ruled over those particular territories, which is very, very critical. And then the next phase that we would make reference to in the image is the Western Roman divided empire, because that's where we come into the toe phase. Rome was divided into 10 phases throughout the Western Dominion. And they're represented on this map here. And we'll talk a little bit more about those 10 toes as we go through and make some references. Some of the general principles that I think are really important about Nebuchadnezzar's image, and this is just the quick overview, is the image, all the metals are seen destroyed together. That is a very, very important fact, right? When we look in Daniel chapter 2, and when we examine verse 45, we see that, you know, it's not just the iron feet that are destroyed by the stone cut out of the mountain without hands. It's everything from the head of gold to the iron feet. Now, in order for that to happen, the head of gold has to exist in the latter days. Cannot be broken to pieces and ground to powder unless it exists as well. Another important point is that only 3/4 of the image has ruled over the Assyrian Babylonian territory. Rome has never yet done so. So to be consistent with the blueprint of prophecy that Iron Dominion is still destined to rule over the Assyrian-Babylonian territory. In Ezra 4, 5, 5:13, and 6:22, look at these. Those of you that have heard me on this, you probably already copied these down. But if you look at those references, it's very interesting. I'm trying not to be too long-winded here, but let's do that. Let's look at these. Ezra 4, 5, I don't think it'll take that much time that it'll be a problem. But remember, Ezra is in the time, okay, of the Persian ruler. And just make note of the three titles that Cyrus is given in the book of Ezra. In chapter 4, all right, of Ezra, in verse 5, he is called King of Persia. In chapter 5, in verse 13, he is called King of Babylon. That's pretty interesting because he wasn't a Babylonian. But he's called King of Babylon. And then in chapter 6 and verse 22, he's called the King of Assyria. So that's a really important principle that's taught in what Nebuchadnezzar saw, is that we're waiting for a time where this image stands head to toe so that the Iron Dominion can be called the King of Rome, the King of Greece, the King of Medo-Persia, the King of Babylon, King of Assyria. So that's an extremely important aspect of the image that hasn't existed yet. So therefore, the image has never yet stood. What Daniel saw has never yet existed in its completed form, which is very important. We're told in Daniel 7, verses 23 and 24, that the 10 toes are 10 kings. And I think we can get to that pretty easy, because in Daniel 7, 23, 24, he says the fourth beast, this is a different vision, but note that he says the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth. Well, that takes him back to Daniel chapter 2, because Daniel was very particular in calling these empires and the image kingdoms. So he says the fourth beast is the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms and shall devour the whole earth and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. And 10 horns, the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings. And then just to go a little bit further into understanding the latter day application of some of these things, you'll note that in Revelation, in the Apocalypse, in chapter 17, in verse 12, there is a reappearance of these 10 kings. Because in 17:12, we are told there that the 10 horns which thou sawest of the scarlet-colored beast are 10 kings. And there's an equation there from this beast to Nebuchadnezzar's image. So that blueprint of prophecy is very important, because I think as we look at current events, we should always be asking, you know, what's happening now that's going to help lead to this standing of this image head to toe? What's happening that's going to help lead to this unification of all of these territories from Babylon to Rome into one grand empire? And it's also, let's go back and think one moment. There's one thing that we constantly hear, or occasionally, let me not use such a definite word as constantly. We sometimes hear that Nebuchadnezzar's image represents the kingdom of men. Well, that's not right, I would suggest to you. Nebuchadnezzar's image represents particular territories of the kingdom of men. For instance, as we pointed out, Saudi Arabia was never included in the dominion of any of these metallic parts. So the image only represents a specific portion of the kingdom of men. It represents that portion of the kingdom of men that also is represented in Ezekiel 38, in Gog's dominion. And so that becomes pretty important as well. Now, you look at this particular chart, and maybe I should have made it just a tad bit larger, but once again, notice where Saudi Arabia is on here. When we go through Ezekiel 38, you know, how is Saudi Arabian Peninsula mentioned in there? It's mentioned as Sheba and Dedan, right? So I think one of the things that you might ask yourself as we see these things happening in the news, how is what's going on in the world, how are the Elohim putting people in place so that Saudi Arabia is not part of this grand coalition? And sometimes it's not easy, I think, to piece all this together. You know, we see up here in this territory, we see Ezekiel 38 mentions the Russian dominion when it talks about Meshech and Tubal, when it talks about Rosh, the term which the Encyclopedia Britannica says is the most ancient term of Russia. We see the land of Magog mentioned in Ezekiel 38, Gomer and all of his bands. One thing about this chart that I've always liked is you've got two different groups represented here, the light brown of Gog, and it's kind of purple, isn't it? You know, the Tarshish powers, Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish. So we ask ourselves as we start going through all of these things, you know, how are all these nations being arranged so all this will take place? You know, how is it that all nations are going to be motivated to come to Jerusalem? You know, what are the things that's going to put all this in action? And so I think that we see some movements going on today that, you know, we wonder about. We wonder, you know, what all the stuff that's going on with Iran, you know, what's this leading to? You know, how does this fit in with things? And I think that, you know, ultimately, the one thing that is conclusive in my mind is that when we talk about, well, you know, look, are these nuclear plans of Iran, are they going to be attacked or not, or what? Where's it going? It seems, you know, we don't really know. Things keep getting pushed off. Just note in the current events when you read these stories how it is forging an even greater alliance between Russia and ancient Persia. You know, I think that's the one thing that's truly, really important in the equation. All the other stuff, we may not know how it really fits into things. It certainly has led to a more antagonistic relationship between the Tarshish powers in Persia, and certainly that plays into things. You know, we look at the events as they relate to Turkey and we ask what's going on. You know, for the last several years, Turkey's been really on the outs with Israel. And all of a sudden now it looks like things are becoming friendly, you know, once again. And you might ask yourself why. And I think when we pay really attention to the politics of the day, it's because, you know, Turkey's in a really tough spot. You know, they are a Muslim country, but they're not really liked. They're not really liked by the Arab states. You know, they're not really Arab enough for them. You know, they are constantly pressed upon, you know, by the King of the North, by Russia themselves, and that puts them in a tough spot as well. You know, they are in a position right now with this Syrian war to help exacerbate things. You know, and that might bear our watching. I mean, Turkey has already gone to the point where they've extended this little buffer into Syria that they for all the refugees, and that's created some problems. In fact, we forget possibly, but there was a story just several months ago of the Turkish fighter pilot that was shot down. And of course, what eventually came out in the news? Who actually was it that shot that jet down? Was it a Syrian, you know, military personnel? No, it was the Russian consultants who shot that jet down. So, you know, those things bear attention. You know, everything that's still going on in Egypt bears our attention because, you know, what started almost a year and a half ago with Egypt seems to still continue today. Isaiah 19 says in the last days that the Egyptians will be set against themselves. Have they come out of that? Are they still, they're still just against themselves. They can't get things together enough in their own country to ever really take a stand right now militarily or anything against Israel. I mean, they are a thorn in their side, right? They let supplies into Gaza. They let things of terror go back and forth. I mean, they do that. But I think we're really starting to see why Egypt is never mentioned as a coalition of Ezekiel 38, of Gog's coalition, aren't we? That's coming together quite nicely. Now, this is just kind of one of those things that I like to point out, and maybe not always agreed to. You know, one of the groups of Ezekiel 38 that's made mention to also is the Libyans and the Ethiopians. Well, Ethiopia, you know, the identity of Ethiopia biblically is not limited to just one territory. This is a very old map, and you probably can't read it great here, but right along here on the Tigris and Euphrates, this is Kushistan. All right? And so I think it, I've always thought that this is the biggest portion of the Ethiopian power. Now, we can't ignore scripturally that Cush is referenced as a power that goes from here to in, well, it's not on the map. We could go a little bit further down. We can't ignore that without question, but I think what it does tell us that if we're going to pay attention to the current events of the Cush power, we still have to pay attention to what's going on in Iraq today, as well as where Cush extends to into Ethiopia. We need to pay attention to all of those things. And there's a lot that's taking place even there that bears our attention. So a lot of things are happening in the world that are really important to the molding of nations. But I think the most significant of all the current events for me is the current economic crisis that is being felt in all the countries. Now, everybody knows this verse very well that's on the overhead. We'll look at it and read it. Ezekiel 38 and verse 13. Because we know that the remark that is given as to Gog's invasion by Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish has to do with money. Verse 13 of Ezekiel 38. Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish, with all the young lions thereof, shall say unto thee, art thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou gathered thy company to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to take a great spoil? Well, finance then becomes a real great portion of Gog's invasion based on what Ezekiel 38 says here. And I think this worldwide financial crisis is very critical. And for me, there's two things in play here. Number one, I think when we look at the finances of the world, there seems to be no way to fix it. And I don't think there is a way for flesh and blood to fix it. The second portion that I always think about is, as bad as things are getting financially for the nations, the return of the Lord, to me, seems to have to come before they get too bad. Or why do I say that? Because there has to still be an ability to wage war. There still has to be an ability to take men, personnel, and troops, and ships, and planes, and to be able to send them into such a great conflict. Now, you know, how many of the nations are going to be gathered to Jerusalem to battle? Just a couple? All nations. So, I think as we're looking at this financial crisis, what should be occurring to us is that the Lord's return is near, because things are about ready to fall apart financially. I mean, there's no way out of it, it appears to me. But they can't get too bad before the Lord's return, because these nations have to be prepared even after Christ returns to wage war for a period of 30 years, right? We know that there's going to be the 10-year everlasting gospel proclamation followed by the 30 years of the 1 hour with the beast. So there has to be enough held together to be able to accomplish these things. So I don't think things have to get horribly worse with finance to make all these things come together. to play. I do think that it's interesting that what's happening in this country and the effect that it's having on the Middle East. I think the sequester, one of the things that I found that's very interesting, well, there's a couple of things that occurred. What's the first thing that happened with the sequester in regards to the Middle East? President Obama says, okay, we're going to be down to one aircraft carrier now in the Gulf region. No longer two. We can't do this anymore. So immediately, the second aircraft carrier that was scheduled to go out into the Gulf of Aqaba area, into the Persian Gulf area, is not there. So the military presence of the Tarshish powers have already been weakened, which I think is critical in Gog's move into the area. He has to be able to succeed with an overwhelming force. And I think when we look at things, if we back up 10 years, would Russia actually think they have an overwhelming ability to take control of this area? I don't think so. But do you think with what's happening in this country with finances and now the scaling back of military hardware and of personnel is going to start to entice Russia a bit? I think so. We have 4 years to go of this particular administration, and I think it's going to have a huge effect on the readiness of personnel in the area. I think there will still be an ability to participate in the Armageddon conflict. So I think there's two things about verse 13 to take there. Don't get yourself to the opinion that all that Sheba and Dedan and Tarshish go is stick up their hands and go, well, hey, what are you doing here? Are you come to take a spoil and they can't do anything militarily? Because there's other scriptures that say that's not the case. All nations will be gathered to Jerusalem. But we know they will not be able to stop the Gogian invader from entering into the Holy Land and setting its tabernacle upon the mountains of Jerusalem. With this economic crisis, I think it's also very interesting that this week, Israel produced its first gas from the rich fields that it shares in the Mediterranean with countries such as Cyprus and Lebanon. And energy is power. Energy, and that's not a pun, we know energy creates power. Energy makes for power. Right? Energy has taken Russia from being one of the nation's huge debtor nations to one with huge wealth. Gazprom, one of the world's most powerful energy entities now, and it has taken that nation into a wealthy nation rather than a debtor nation. So Israel seems to be set up to help with what is taking place with Ezekiel 38:13. I mean, certainly, they're already an economic power in other ways. You know, we used to talk about the U.S. as being the breadbasket of the world. Well, Israel's become the breadbasket of Europe. All right, so there's already a lot there for them. But now that they have already gotten the ability to get this gas out of the Tamar fields, can we imagine the wealth that's going to be attractive? And can we imagine how Russia might be worried about that? What's this going to do with our position in the world when it comes to this power? These things of the current economic crisis certainly bear our paying attention to. Now, this map is 4 years old. All right, this was from 2008. And this was a chart that I used several years ago. I could not find one currently that was updated like this. But we talk about the debt that exists in the countries. You know, we talk about the U.S. Well, when this chart was done, the USA had a debt of $8 trillion. Anybody know what it is now? 16. It's doubled. $8 trillion, and the debt-to-GDP ratio was only in the 60% range. Well, that's a whole lot worse now. When you think about Russia, look at what their debt was. 4 years ago, $151 billion. And it's not a whole lot worse today. You know, that's what energy has done for them. They only had a debt-to-GDP ratio 4 years ago of 6.8%, which is extraordinarily low. Now, I took a screenshot of this website 2 nights ago, the U.S. debtclock.org calendar that constantly monitors debt for you. And I think one of the things that's interesting here is you look 4 years later, our debt ratio has gone from, debt to GDP has gone from 60 to 75%. Look at Russia, 14%. Interesting. Look at some of these other countries that might be of note to you. Greece. What just happened in Greece this week? Debt to GDP, 178%. And isn't it interesting that you look at what happened in Greece this week and Russia didn't really make a lot of comment on it publicly where you might expect it. For the young people that may not have paid attention, Greece seized 40% of everybody's bank account last week. Whatever you had in the bank, 40% of it became the country's. Whatever you'd worked hard for your whole life for and built up for your own retirement, 40%, it's not yours anymore. It belongs to the government. And there's two different competing news stories on this. Either Russia got their money out ahead of time because a lot of Russian money is in this area. I think I just said Greece. I meant to say Cyprus. Caught myself there, but needed to correct that. It's Cyprus that this happened. But there's a lot of talk. No, they really didn't get their money out, and they're not that worried about it because it's leverage for the gas fields that they want to get to with Cyprus. So money's becoming a real issue. And you look all through this chart, and you look at the nations who owe a lot of money and those who don't, and things are just quickly spiraling out of control. In 4 years, this country's debt has doubled. Russia's, little bit of change, but they're still very healthy. Nations like China, still very low in debt to GDP and still very powerful. I think the only reason the U.S. debt has been seen by some as being sustainable, though I don't know how you could consider $16 trillion in debt being sustainable, and this, we don't really need to get into the politics of all that. We just sit back as Christadelphians, we watch this argument, and we realize there's no help coming from man on this issue, right? That they can't figure it out themselves. But the only reason I think that it's been sustainable at all is for two things. The size of the U.S. economy is still the world's largest economy, though it's estimated in 5 years China will supersede that. And I think the second reason is the world economies, even though they don't like the U.S., they've got so much money wrapped up into us right now. I mean, you hear talk all the time about the U.S. dollar is no longer going to be the world's currency, that they want to get rid of that. But does it ever happen? I mean, it happened to Britain in the 70s, but it was a different situation then when it happened to Britain than it is today. Because all these countries today that talk about maybe taking the dollar away as the world's currency, they're so heavily invested in the U.S. dollar, they can't afford for that to happen. So U.S. Mint just keeps printing money right now and making everybody's dollar more and more worthless. And it's just all of these things are leading to an economic situation of chaos that I think builds upon Ezekiel 38:13 that bears us paying attention to. And the nations of the world financially are in horrible, horrible shape. And even though you've got some wealthy countries like Russia and China, it won't stay that healthy when the rest of the world's finances totally collapse. They may be there thinking they can pick up, you know, the pieces, but that's not the way today works. And I'll say this before I go on. I know I've already gone on to the next slide, but, you know, young people, you've heard in school about the Great Depression. Well, I think we're heading that way, you know, again, but there's one horrible difference. When your grandparents lived through the Great Depression, most everybody had the family farm, and they could at least feed themselves. We go through another Great Depression now. How many of you can grow your own food? You know, what we're heading for, if we return to what happened just 80 years ago, the world cannot sustain itself through that kind of an event any longer. All right? The Syrian war. I think this is something we're paying a lot of attention to, but I think maybe we're we're a little bit puzzled. Where does this play out? How is this affecting the plan of the deity? What are the Elohim doing here? And I think it certainly bears attention from our part. Now, I'm going to summarize a couple of these articles that I've got. I intended on reading a couple of them completely, but I'm not going to do that. One story that came out this week that was extremely interesting, there was an Arab summit going on that broke up on the 28th of March. And it broke up because of a fist fight. And this fist fight broke out because Saudi Arabia is now giving heavy armaments to the rebels in Syria. All right? They are now supplying them with rocket launchers, large upscale operation of supply of that. They're providing them with several heavy armaments, 220-millimeter rockets that have a distance of, you know, capability of over 70 kilometers. They're giving the rebels a lot of what they need to fight against Assad. Now, you think about that. That's pretty interesting. Here you have this Arab summit going on, and it breaks up because of the fist fights that are going out in the room between the Saudi Arabians and the rest of the Arab delegates. What does that tell us about Sheba and Dedan in the Merchants of Tarshish? Now, don't confuse the fact that the U.S. is also really concerned about, you know, who do we supply here? How do we do it? How's this going to come back to affect us? What it does really, I think, show for us is the position of the Sheba and Dedan power in relation to another world power. Because who is it that is supplying most of the weapons that Assad needs right now to continue this war? It's Russia and Iran. So we've got Russia and Iran on one side giving all of the supplies that Assad needs to stay in power, and you've got people like Saudi Arabia who are not a part of the Gogian Confederacy opposing them. I think that's one significant outcome to pay attention from here. I think it's also interesting that during the tour through the Middle East, Obama said, okay, enough's enough. These chemical weapons, we got to find a way to take them out. And right now there's two competing news stories going on, and who knows which one is the truth or what will really happen. I think a lot of times when you watch these current events and the world powers, they get together in a room and say, okay, this is what we got to do. And then they go off into their own corners, and all of a sudden what they think they got to do, they're not sure about, and, you know, don't know what to do. Different plans come out, but you don't know what's going to happen. But right now there's two military plans on the table as far as the U.S. is concerned. One, limited troops on the ground, up to 75,000 foot soldiers to take out Assad's chemical weapons, is one option that's on the table. And then there's another option that's on the table that involves no boots on the ground, but just air power. There has been a command set up at MacDill Air Force Base. The U.S. has been set in charge of a coalition that's looking at how we're going to take out these chemical weapons. How do you think Russia feels about that? You start to see some pieces moving here that are very, very critical. Go on to DEBKA. If you can't find that website, just Google it, DEBKA, and read some of these stories. I find them to be very interesting and very, very fascinating. Iran helping out in this situation is once again extremely interesting. They never get beat back by Russia, not really. They never get told to play nice in the sandbox, not really. Russia's there to support them. But Iran's made it very clear, and Iran is really upset with Turkey right now on some of these missile defenses they've been establishing in the area. And they've stated that every one of these Patriot missiles is a dark spot on the world map and is aimed at starting a world war. I mean, that's Iran's official position on Turkey right now. Can you see a lot of things that are going that might lead to this great conflict that will come in the time of the end? Russia is certainly very, very supportive of Assad. They're not going to drop that. They've got a lot tied up into that. And I think we certainly see some pieces falling into place here. Now, how does this affect Russia's role as the King of the North? I think becomes the real question. All right, now I've rambled on for a little bit, so let's take our minds back to Scripture for a moment and just think about this. We've all looked forward to the day when Russia will assume the power of the King of the North. Where does that title come from us in Scripture? It comes from watching the development of the Seleucid Empire, and we primarily think about what's taking place in Turkey. I mean, for over 150 years, Christadelphians have looked for the day when Russia will move against Turkey. And we've all expected that conflict to come just from, you know, Russia just coming across the, you know, the Baltic or whatever and just invading the country. Maybe there's a little bit of a backdoor approach going on here when you think about it to this empire, because one of the things we don't often talk about is how most of the Syrian country was part of the Seleucid Empire at one point in time. So look at all this territory here that is now, I think I've got my red dot right now on Aleppo. That was all part of the Seleucid Empire at one point in time. It went up into Turkey, all right, Ptolemaic down here, and then you've got the other two divisions of Alexander's empire that was divided over here. But right now, all of this bickering that's going on, and who's going to help Syria, who's not, what kind of help are we going to get? Saudi Arabia supplying, or the U.S. going to supply? Russia is supplying, could be the Elohim's way of working things out to bring about Russia's role as the King of the North a whole lot quicker than what might need to develop with just Turkey alone. The entirety of that King of the North empire now seems to be drawing into war with Turkey, Syria on opposite sides, which I think may be one of the real keys that brings Russia into the territory as being the King of the North. And when Russia establishes itself as the King of the North, the image will stand. So I think that's interesting for us to look at, and a very important current event. But I think also this week particularly we've seen in the news, you know, another current event which maybe we're all paying a lot of attention to. You know, there is a moral decline that exists in the world that gets worse and worse and worse all the time. You know, those of us who are in our 50s probably had a hard time, even when we read the Scriptures and we saw what the Scriptures said, probably had a hard time imagining where we would be at today. Let's look at Luke 17. All right, verses 28 to 32. Likewise also as it was in the days of Lot, they did eat, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they builded. But the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. In that day, he which shall be upon the housetop and his stuff in the house, let him not come down to take it away, and he that is in the field, let him likewise not return back. Remember Lot's wife. All right. Sodom had a lot of problems, okay, and a lot of moral problems, and didn't have just one moral problem, just like the world today doesn't have just one moral problem. But its greatest problem is where we get the word sodomy from. Its greatest problem lies in the fact that homosexuality was rampant within Sodom. Now, what's happening this week? We know that the Supreme Court of this country heard two cases that reflect to gay marriage. Are homosexuals going to be allowed to be married or not? If we look at people who are in high school now and in college, I think the majority of people see this as a human rights issue. And I think that reflects where society has changed on these things. You know, some of us may have always read these verses that Lot today would be like the coming of the Son of Man, but probably never could have thought that we would get to a point to where probably most people in this country favor the prospect of gay marriage. But Even though there are a lot of other moral problems, what does Leviticus say about this? We just kind of read through this in our daily readings not too long ago. Sometimes everything feels like it happened yesterday for me, and I know we're further along than that now. In Leviticus chapter 20 and verse 13. If a man also lie with mankind as he lieth with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood shall be upon them. Now, there are a lot of moral issues in this world, but there are few moral issues which God has called an abomination. There are a lot of things that we can do wrong in this world, but there are just a few that the Lord said was deserving of death, even in and of itself. Now, we know death is a logical outcome of all sin, but as far as a death penalty, we know that it was a big problem in Sodom, because in Genesis 19 and verse 5, when the Elohim entered into the city, the men of the city said, "Bring them out that we may know them." And we know that the Hebrew word for know there is the same word that's used in Genesis 4:1, where it says Adam knew his wife Eve and bare a son, and they named him Cain. So we know that the word know there in the English simply doesn't mean how do you do, because this resulted in the birth of Cain when it comes to Adam and Eve. So, you know, they were asking to know the men. And it details the sexuality problem that existed in that particular era. Lot was pulled out of that environment. And I think we should be exhorted. How long is it going to be until we're pulled out of this environment? I would suggest don't be surprised if the Supreme Court of this country comes back and says, constitutionally, there's nothing against this. You know, a lot of what this country was based on morally would be outrage, but constitutionally, I'm not so sure they're going to rule against this. I'm not sure I see how. And I think it's just going to be another sign for us of where we are at in the current events. And it's not just this country. It's all countries. Israel's, all countries are like this. And it should tell us that if the days of Sodom and Gomorrah were so evil that the Lord had to put an end to it, that end is coming as well in our era. Luke said that when we see all these signs, and Luke's reference to the Olivet Prophecy, I think, is appropriate here, because when you get to verse 28, Luke goes into a latter-day application that the other two accounts do not deal with. But when we get to these things, we're supposed to lift up our heads, because our redemption draweth nigh. Now, point number one, Israel, peace at last. I think relatively that's a truism. You know, they haven't fought a major war that brought their citizens in the country at risk like they did in, you know, 72 and earlier in a long time. Peace is a relative term there, I think. But I think we're seeing that. Russia certainly is in an era of empire building. And this goes back to the economic crisis that we were in. I can't remember now if it was in 1991 that Soviet Union broke up. I think that's when it was. They were in such horrible shape financially that many Christadelphians said, well, there's no way they're the Gogian power. They're just not capable of it. They don't have the resources. They don't have the military. Everything was in ruin. Their ships were rusted. Their tanks were all rusted up. They couldn't pay their military. But look where we are now, 21 years later. Certainly, they're back to empire building. We just had a new pope appointed, and I think we're all anxious to see how he involves himself in all of these current events. How will the Elohim nudge him along to do certain things? But I think we also see that point four is a real exhortation to us. And I think something that at this point in time for all of us needs to be very critical. We need to make sure that when it comes to the truth, that we do not fall into a position where we lose our first love. That's a quote from Revelation chapter 2, and I'm not going to go into a great deal here. I just want to simply you know, make the point that in the Ephesian ecclesia, which was an ecclesia that was not condemned for how it was, you know, its beliefs in the truth, right? It was chastised because it had lost its first love. In chapter 2, verse 3 and 4, it says, "You've borne, you've had patience for my name's sake, you've labored, you haven't fainted. Nevertheless, I have somewhat against thee because thou hast left thy first love." You know, they had labored and endured for the truth, but they weren't laboring and enduring for the truth for the love of the truth. And I think that that's a real exhortation for all of us to make sure that we do not lose our love for the truth. Because that is something that I think is happening in the ecclesias today, that things are done that don't involve love for the truth. Matthew chapter 22, verse 36 through 40. "Master, which is the great commandment of the law?" Jesus said unto him, "Thou shalt love Yahweh thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." We need to make sure we don't forget our first love, our first obligations, our first duties to the truth. It's not enough that we do the right things. It's required that we do the right things for the right reason. And we all need to be, I think, mindful in these days when the world is pressing so much evil upon us that we have to ask ourselves, are we losing our love for the truth? Are we falling back into the world? And I think that's the real exhortation here. Are we falling back into the ways of the world? In our own lives, do we do everything that expresses our love for the truth, or is the world so prevalent upon us that we can't escape it? Are we ensnared by the things of the world? Are we going to be like Lot's wife? The Lord's return, are the things of that Lot's wife loved going to be our love? Or will it be the truth? We can be completely assured that the Elohim are working to bring all nations to Jerusalem. All nations are being brought to Jerusalem. We need to make sure that we're prepared because we know we will be called away before that event. The bottom line here on this overhead, I just think, is a good exhortation for you in the room. If you do not know the Scriptures and are not baptized, you're not ready. If you know the Scriptures, it's time to make a choice, I think, or to be thinking about that. I don't often do this kind of thing, but you know, I think there comes to be a point in our lives where we have to exhort our young people that, you know, look, there may not be a lot of time left for you to make a decision on these things. We never want to be in a position where we push people too early to make a commitment to the truth that they're not prepared for. So I guess I would say to you, if you intellectually know that there's no hope for you in the world, and pay any attention to the news, young people, and you'll see there's nothing that it's got to offer you because it's in financial ruin. You know, 50 years ago or maybe 30 years ago, maybe I look out and there's a lot of good things to pursue. But now chaos is coming. You should know that there's really only one thing out there for you, and that's the truth. And set your heart to those things because we know that the time is coming when this world is going to come to an end. And you could all quote Daniel chapter 2, right? You could all quote verse 44, I should say. You know, what is it that when this image stands head to toe that we see in that particular verse? In the days of these kings, right? What is God going to do? He's going to set up a kingdom which would break in pieces all these other kingdoms and consume it, destroy them all. And that time, I think, without a doubt, is surely coming, and we need to be prepared. Pay attention to what's happening in the news. Be mindful. What is it that the Elohim are doing right now? Because I think some things that are happening that are extremely significant that we really don't have a grasp on how significant they are.
Offer our thanks to Brother Mac for those words, and certainly they help prepare us for the next part of our service as well, as we consider our shared hope together, and we'll have a few words that will touch some of Daniel's thoughts in that regard as well. Before we do that, let's stand and sing together hymn number 155 for the breaking of bread. Bread of heaven, on thee we feed, for thy flesh is meat indeed. Ever may our souls be fed with this true and living bread. Hymn number 155. The Orlando Ecclesia's basis of fellowship is exclusively the unamended statement of faith, and we welcome those who believe and adhere to those doctrines and commandments stated therein. The reminder that we've just heard about our responsibility in the Ecclesia to maintain our first love, as Ephesus failed to do, is one that has resonated strongly with me personally lately, because if I had to sum up what the last 5 to 10 years have been like, the only word I can think of is fatigue. Because truly, we are living in a very difficult age for the maintenance of the truth. We look around us and we see so many challenges when it comes to a relaxed hold on doctrine, walk issues, poor attendance, lack of personal accountability. These things are very discouraging to us, and we know they're a reflection of what's happening in the world today. So the message for us is, how do we maintain a focus on our calling and collectively at these times retain our strength and get through those things together? And there's an individual that I'd like to take a look at who I think if we can see and emulate the intense love and desire that he had for the knowledge of the truth, it's something that can be very encouraging to us, and we'll look at that in conjunction with our memorial remarks today. But there is something that has become very real for me lately is just the constant remembrance of the fact that what we do here on Sunday mornings from 9:30 to 12:30 is profoundly important. It's not just an important part of our week. It is our central focus for the week. Nothing in the world can stop us from doing this and observing this time together. And I want to look at this individual. Turn with me, please, to Acts chapter 8. And there are so many beautiful symbols to be seen in the Ethiopian eunuch. But starting at verse 26, we read the following. The angel of the Lord spake unto Philip, saying, Arise and go toward the south unto the way that goeth down from Jerusalem into Gaza, which is desert. And he arose and went, and behold, a man of Ethiopia, an eunuch of great authority under Candace, queen of the Ethiopians, who had the charge of all her treasure, and had come to Jerusalem for to worship, was returning, and sitting in his chariot, read Isaiah the prophet. Then the Spirit said unto Philip, Go near, and join thyself to this chariot. And Philip ran thither to him, and heard him read the prophet Isaiah, and said, Understandest thou what you readest? And he said, How can I, except some man should guide me? And he desired Philip that he would come up and sit with him. And the place of the scripture which he read was this, He was led as a sheep to the slaughter, and like a lamb dumb before his shearer, so opened he not his mouth. In his humiliation his judgment was taken away, and who shall declare his generation? For his life is taken from the earth. And the eunuch answered Philip and said, I pray thee. And just imagine the intensity of his voice as he begged for this understanding. Of whom speaketh the prophet this? Of himself or of some other man? Then Philip opened his mouth and began at the same scripture and preached unto him Jesus. And let's turn over to Isaiah chapter 53. We consider this man and his intense desire to learn and to understand the truth. He's reading this passage. Isaiah 53, starting at verse 1. Who hath believed our report, and to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of a dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness, and when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows, and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities, and the chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he openeth not his mouth. He was taken from prison and from judgment. And who shall declare his generation? For he was cut off out of the land of the living. For the transgression of my people was he stricken. And he made his grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, because he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth. Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him, he hath put him to grief. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. He shall see of the travail of his soul, and shall be satisfied. By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he hath poured out his soul unto death. And he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bare the sin of many, and made intercession for the transgressors. To what specifics Philip and the eunuch spoke, we're not told. But we do know that his understanding of the Messiah was profoundly impacted that day, so much that he was prepared for baptism. In our exhortation today, we looked at a number of references from Daniel, and we'll take a look at some of those in just a moment. But Jesus himself often turned to the prophets in an effort to bring his apostles to a fuller understanding of his purpose and of his role. And after his resurrection, when he appeared to the two on the road to Emmaus, we're told in Luke 24 that their eyes were holden that they should not know him, and his identity was masked. But what he talked about during that time, and we won't read that, but just jot down a note in Luke 24, 18 through 27. Christ, you know, with his identity masked to these individuals, he turns to the law and to the prophets, and he brings them to a realization of his legitimacy and his position. And he explains that to them, and of course their eyes are then opened as he's taken away. So once again, in back in Acts, we aren't told to which passages the Lord referred to in that dialogue. Excuse me, in Luke, we're not told which passages Christ referred to in the dialogue. But a couple that really outline the course of events that has and will transpire to bring about the return of the Messiah and the realization of Yahweh's plan with the earth can be found in Daniel. We heard a number of these at our gathering. We really had an exceptional gathering. We heard many very encouraging words. And Brother Mack has alluded to a number of those today. But turn with me to Daniel 6, because there's a few verses. We're not going to read a lot of this, but I do want to read some individual verses, because they portray so beautifully the identification of the Messiah and who he was. His designation by his father, his fitness to accomplish the sacrificial role, his rejection by his brethren, his triumphant return to the earth to rule it. These thoughts are certainly appropriate to prepare our minds for the memorials today and the greater Daniel. Daniel 6, verse 3 and 4 read, an excellent spirit was in him. The king thought to set him over the whole realm. Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find none occasion nor fault. For as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. This is a story that's we see reflected elsewhere. We know that. In verse 10, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day. He prayed. He gave thanks before his God. Verse 14, the king, when he heard these words, what had been done, was sore displeased and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. And of course, in verses 16 and 17, they brought Daniel, they cast him into the den of lions, and a stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel. Verses 22 and 23, my God hath sent his angel and hath shut the lions' mouths, that they have not hurt me. For as much as before him innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt. So Daniel was taken up out of the den. No manner of hurt was found upon him, because he believed in his God. And then jumping down to verse 26, I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is a living God and steadfast forever. In his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. He delivereth and rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth. So this Daniel prospered. And finally, three short verses from the next chapter, Daniel chapter 7. And these are the things that should be very encouraging to us. Verses 13 and 14, I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him glory and dominion, dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. And then finally, verse 27. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. So as our thoughts prepare to dwell on the current and future role of the Messiah, we partake in this service to recall his obedience, his sacrifice, and his successful fulfillment of all that his Father required. As Daniel did, so did Christ. We would do well to remember these things, pattern ourselves after them, and when we discover that there is difficulty in doing so, we look to individuals like the Ethiopian eunuch, who found such joy in recognizing the truth and its availability to him that he embraced it immediately and would have done nothing to stop himself from getting all the knowledge that he could and using that in his life. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Starting at verse 23, 1 Corinthians 11, 23. For I have received of the Lord that which also I delivered unto you, that the Lord Jesus, the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he brake it and said, Take, eat, this is my body, which is broken for you. This do in remembrance of me. And after the same manner also he took the cup when he had supped, saying, This cup is the New Testament in my blood. This do ye as oft as ye drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you do show the Lord's death till he come. At this time we'll stand. And Brother Luke, could I ask you to offer word for prayer for the bread, please? At this time we'll stand and offer thanksgiving for the wine. Brother Bobby, could I ask you to come up and do that? Just a brief final reading related to Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch. Starting at verse 36 of Acts chapter 8, once Philip has enlightened him to an understanding of the truth, once his eyes are open to this, he immediately recognizes the urgency behind baptism. And I mention this because Brother Mac alluded to it as well. And he says, See, here is water. What doth hinder me to be baptized? Philip says, If thou believest with all thine heart, thou mayest. And he answered and said, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And he baptized him. And only one chapter later, we see another man who has his eyesight taken away and then reopened to an understanding of the truth. We see Peter, who has to come to an understanding of the Gentiles' role. This idea of knowledge through the Scripture increasing an individual's ability to see and understand is one that we repeatedly see. And as we come together to study and to learn and to participate in classes together, this is our opportunity. And we're reminded of it here very appropriately. Let's close our service today by singing together Anthem 19 and 21. We'll do our little segue where we finish 19 and jump over to 21. And after that, I'd like to call on Brother David Pirtle. Would you offer a word of closing prayer, please? Anthem 19, the Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face to shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace.